Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We will start off a series of public hearings today with Senate Bill 251. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 251. And we'll get a quick summary. Christine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, Senate Bill 251 would increase the revenue by which, or the revenue, or the cutoff by which lottery winnings would become subject to withholding. And so it actually puts withholding on a lottery winning above $1,500, and that's a lower limit than the one that is currently in place.
Okay, that is a brief summary as called for.
Good morning.
Senator Taylor, did you want to testify in support of this bill?
Yes. Okay, so I will just stay right here. Sounds like that's the common practice. For the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21, Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. Senate Bill 251 lowers the prize amount that is subject to automatic tax withholding from $5,000 to $1,500. This automatic prize withholding amount has been lowered during fiscal year 2016. If it were lowered, it would have impacted 23,470 total prizes for a total prize amount of $50,871,903. The 8% tax, which is the tax applied, would have amounted to $4,871,752. DOR learned from information collected in 2010 that approximately 40% of winners under the $5,000 threshold did not report the prize on their taxes. The $1,500 amount limit was chosen to ensure an absorbable fiscal impact and will have a significant positive impact on DOR's ability to obtain the tax amounts efficiently, as fewer taxes on lottery prizes will need to be collected through enforcement measures. The Department of Revenue gathered various input from key agencies and individuals, including the Oregon Lottery. I believe that Deanna Mack from DOR, as well as Barry Pack, the director of Oregon Lottery, are here, and they can provide more specifics on the bill. So thank you, and I urge everyone on the committee support for Senate Bill 251.
Okay, thank you. So Barry Pack and Deanna are here. You guys want to come up?
Two people who gamble with our money daily. Yeah, revenue.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And Senator Taylor did exactly a very good job of describing what this bill does. We have a mirror bill in the House that does the same thing that we brought forward for the agency. So we would definitely support you and urge an aye vote on this bill and move it forward. It is a tool, like Senator Taylor said, that would help us with our enforcement efforts.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Barry Pack, director of the Oregon Lottery. We're here to support the bill. We think that the change from $5,000 to $1,500 will have a relatively minor impact on staff workload and a couple of minor system changes. The withholding process is already automated in our accounting and prize payment system, so lowering it down to that $1,500 mark is quite doable. Anything lower than that starts to cause problems because some of those tracking systems are actually at the game level, and so that would have significant programming costs that we might have to bear. But at the $1,500 level, which aligns well with IRS regulations for our reporting obligations, we see no problem and would urge your support for the bill.
Right. There's an implicit understanding that people in this category, lottery winners below a certain amount or above a certain amount, aren't always the best at filing.
Mr. Chair, it's not necessarily that they're the best at filing, but they sometimes forget that they won a prize, and it doesn't show up on their tax return. We'll find it a couple years later, but by then, you know, it's interest is accrued. This will just prevent that. We'll have the withholding in-house already that we can use towards their their debt, if that's the case.
Oh, I forgot. I won the lottery.
I won $1,500. I forgot all about it. Amazing.
Okay, questions of our panel or Senator Booker?
Deanna, help me out here. And Barry doesn't have to answer this one because this is just purely a tax question. In the deciding between $5 and $1,500, in the IRS code and in our rules, is $1,500 really sort of the threshold that we do across the board? I'm not just talking lottery. But if someone gets X amount of money, that it has to be deductible. I know it's like for labor wages, it's $500 under the IRS code. Is this pretty standard?
For Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, pretty standard for like information return filing, or the reason the $1,500 was chosen for on top of the reasons Barry explained for us is that all prize winners who claim $1,500 or more have to go to the lottery office to claim the prize.
Okay.
Where other locations, they can pay at the retailer level or the machine level, I believe it'll spit it out right there. So that's the reason why we chose that level. It does coincidentally tie with some of our reporting requirements for the IRS, but not but that wasn't the primary reason. Does that answer the question?
No, but I'll follow up.
Okay.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to gain Barry support here, okay? So we'll go back to the original question. I know, for example, if you pay an employee more than $500, you have to do the waging and declaration taxes and all that stuff. Is $1,500, I understand where you got $1,500 because you go to the lottery office and they file the name and the lottery then can, track that. And at some, age, obviously 2 or 3 years now in the future, after they've sent you the list, you're able to cross-reference it. I got that part. What I'm trying to do is establish that I think $1,500 is really above the IRS code, because IRS code is somewhere around $500. If you do something to a non-corporation or an employee or something above $500, okay, you're required to deduct tax deductions below.
Right. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, I think what you're referring to is the filing requirements for the 1099s in our system. So, for 1099 miscellaneous, the threshold is $600 under federal law. If you're not a corporation, you have to issue a 1099. Miscellaneous. I believe the threshold for the Form W-2G, which is what lottery issues, is $1,200. And so that's where that's come. We talked about going down to $1,200, but there's that difference in the retailer payout, and that's why we moved it up $300.
One final question before the good senator.
Senator Boquist.
So in a nutshell there, what we're really doing is, despite this is for lottery collection, so on and so forth, is we're sort of aligning ourselves to the rest of our rule and the rest of their code. Close enough, $1,200,
yes.
Somewhere here. Thank you.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Hess. Barry, you sent me an email that may help to answer what Senator Boquist brought up. So I'm going to go ahead and read directly from your email. Of course, it's on public record to my office. So, of course, with all taxes, we want to make certain that we're not, spending too much money to collect something that is often doesn't make a lot of sense. So I'm going to go ahead and quote here from Director Pack's email. In fiscal year 15, as an example, there were more than 43,000 prizes won by players. Of that total, only 243 were between $600 and $1,500 with a maximum value of around $310,000. With 8% withholding, we would be withholding around $25,000. We would spend many times that amount in vendor charges to get the games to report out at the lower level, and that could be an ongoing expense for each new game release. Do you see where I'm going? It would be built into future game requirements, but could increase development costs if the vendors have to do this differently for Oregon. This is unknown at this point, just a potential risk. So to collect up to, it would only be about $25,000 if we went between $600 and $1,500. So I think that was one of the contributing reasons to have it be at $1,500. It still brings in almost $5 million, pretty much guaranteed, more or less, because we would have control of the money at that time. It should be pretty good.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Same line. Are there any obstacles in DOR's mind in present reporting requirements between lottery and you to ensure efficiency? I mean, are you getting the data you need, and is it coming in the form for our new fancy computer system that someday will give us information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes. We already have this agreement with the lottery now. Mm-hmm. They are currently sending us this information for prize payments that are greater than $5,000 or greater. So it's just more using that same path between our agencies.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Any further comments? All right. Thank you both. We'll let this breathe for a few days before we bring it back for a work session vote. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 251 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 149, Life Flight. Ms. Kyle? Quick summary first.
No. I'm just trying to build support. This committee's actions exceed more than anything. So if you don't build the record.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 149, it does have a dash one amendment as well, which is up there in all lists. So I'll start with the measures introduced and then get into the dash one description. But what Senate Bill 149 would do is it would modify an existing property tax exemption qualification statute, and it allow property of a limited liability company to qualify for exemption from ad valorem property taxation or special assessment if the limited liability company is wholly owned by one or more nonprofit corporations or entities whose property is exempt from taxation under ORS 307090. And the key thing to take away from that is there's an existing process already under 307022 that allows nonprofit corporations to qualify for exemptions that are already on the books as well under law. So it's not creating a new exemption. What 149 does is it allows, in addition to the nonprofit corporations to be part of the LLC, a owner that is exempt under 307090, which is state and local government exemption. So a state or local government could be part of that LLC and still essentially look through to another exemption and qualify. The dash one, it does replace section one, but it keeps with the general concept. One of the differences is it specifies that the exemption of the special assessment that you get, that look through of 307022 that's being changed here, is granted at the least extent possible of any one of the nonprofit owners of the LLC. So if you have two owners and one is the same property, one would qualify for 100% exemption, another would qualify for 50% if they owned the property outright without the LLC, then the exemption would be given at 50%. So it'd be the lowest of the common ownership. There is a court case that is ongoing right now. I have that up in OLIS as well, and I think that'll be spoken to as well.
Okay, Phil Donovan and Greg Chamoff are here. Thank you for coming up. Can you give us a landscape here and why this is needed and what problem it is seeking to solve?
You bet, Mr. Chair. Phil Donovan here on behalf of Life Flight Network. And first off, thank you to the committee for pre-session filing this legislation. And I will lean on Mr. Chamoff here to provide some of the background. And we also have used the interim to reach out to other interested stakeholders. And so we've actually got a couple of amendments that we want to talk to you about that we think will make everybody comfortable with this legislation. So with that, Greg.
Thank you, Phil. Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, representing Life Flight Network. A limited liability company, or LLC, is a form of organization that is simpler and less expensive to manage than a corporation is, particularly when you have a limited number of owners. To allow nonprofit corporations to take advantage of this more efficient kind of organization, you passed ORS 307.022, which allows nonprofit corporations to combine together to manage LLCs. So far, so good. To operate air ambulance service with maximum efficiency, three nonprofit corporation hospitals and OHSU combined together to create Life Flight. And that entity does operate as a nonprofit. Its organizational documents permit it to run an air ambulance service, and only any other activities that further the charitable activities of the entities that own it. The problem that we have is if the three nonprofit corporations ran Life Flight would be exempt. If OHSU runs its own air ambulance service, that property is exempt. But When you mix the two and add a public tax exempt entity and private tax exempt entities, the Department of Revenue and counties have read ORS 307.022 to say that that creates a taxable entity. And that is the issue that has been before the Oregon Tax Court. We think that because this is essentially a matter of public policy, it's best for those who make the public policy to make that decision. The purpose of Senate Bill 149 is to make clear that if you have a private-public partnership that includes nonprofit corporations and a tax-exempt government joining together to perform what is essentially a nonprofit service, that LLC retains the nonprofit or tax-exempt status that the entity would have before the entities combined together. The Dash 1 amendments, which are fine with LifeLight, address a concern of the Department of Revenue. The counties have requested an amendment that would limit the scope of the exemption to air ambulance companies. I believe that that drafting request has gone into LC, and we're an air ambulance company, so we certainly don't have a problem with the measure being limited in that regard. With that, I would be pleased to address any questions you have.
Senator Bokus.
Thank you. You may not know the answer. I'm probably going to go right over the top of Phil's head, and we'll see, Council. Do you know what type of FFA certificate you're applying on, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, no, but I can certainly find that out.
And Kyle, can you go through again your problem with Dash 1? Is
yes, Mr. Chair, there was, had a discussion with Ledge Council on Friday, and the concept of the Dash 1 is fine. There's more, there'd be some language changes to make sure it works the same. The way it's structured right now, it could still not be completely bringing in that 307, that government partnership, because there's a the in there that might be changed. So there's a few tweaks that would just make the Dash 1 work exactly the way it's intended to work. And then there's the other amendment that was mentioned that's from the county assessors. That would be a separate amendment.
And to that end, I think what we submitted, Mr. Chair, under your signature, is an amendment that would take the Dash 1 and build off of it. So we're not going to ask the committee to do multiple amendments. We'll hope to get it done with one, and as soon as that drafting is accomplished, we'll bring it to Legislative Revenue Office.
Okay. Senator Riley?
So the proposed amendment, the one that we don't have yet, would limit this to air ambulances. Does that mean that the next kind of company that does this combination is going to come and we have to change it again? I'm not sure if it's a good idea to allow this for air ambulances. Why is it not a good idea for other entities that are formed the same?
Question for the panel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, leaving the opportunity for other entities like LifeLight to be created and take advantage of what would otherwise be tax exemptions seems like a prudent course of action. However, we're certainly not going to advocate for anything that would make the counties disinclined to support this legislation.
Thank you.
That's a fair answer, Senator Boquist.
Well, that was great tap dancing. Anyway, follow up to my original question here when you get the information, because, you know, it is a required question for a vote either direction, and that is that under the FAA certificate, I also want to know who owns the aircraft, and if they're leased aircraft or their own aircraft, or what's the entity, and how are you you don't know this, but whoever filed for that certificate down that food chain, that's an easy question. They'll be able to tell you that over the phone, and I'm trustworthy enough, of at least of one of you, that if you can just find the type, that's you, Phil, okay? The type of certificate and what is the ownership status, because that will tell us whether this is truly a nonprofit or not.
Very good. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we can do that.
And okay.
I hope that you'll just keep us guessing as to
who you can trust.
You. He's a lawyer. I don't trust
him. That's right, yeah.
All right,
was more
get on
some, we're guessing.
Get a new amendment going and get rid of that wayward the and see what happens. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 149 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 28. Chris Alanak, give us a brief summary. This is the apportionment issue similar to Senate Bill 152, but if there is to be a bill on this year will fall under a broader relating clause that's contained in Senate Bill 28.
Good morning, Chris. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office.
Oh, I know it's bad when you're sitting out there.
And Senate Bill 28 contains an issue relating to the Joyce versus Finnegan, and which is still lingo. And then the dash one deals with a different policy. It's the cost of performance in the market. The way the dash one got drafted, it also contains some other provisions that tie to MTC recommendations, but I just wanted to focus on the cost of performance. So for some context, I have a presentation here. It's about 10 slides to try and go through and try and make sense of some of the lingo that gets bantered about in dealing with corporate taxation. So the first issue here, just really bounce through this quickly, is business income taxation in Oregon. Here I have the different entities and how they get taxed, but our focus here is on C corporations and the multi-state corporations and how that income gets apportioned to Oregon. So some of the key terms in here that get used are nexus, which has to do with whether or not a corporation can be taxed in the state, unitary, it's a collection of companies that can be viewed as one economic unit and can be taxed as a single entity, business income versus non-business income, and that basically gets at which income is allocated, that's the non-business income, and which business income or the business income that gets apportioned. And a lot of the confusion comes up with apportionment. We have a single sales factor. And some of the key things to keep in mind is we're talking about tangible goods versus intangible goods. And Joyce and Finnegan, which is a tangible goods concept, and the cost of performance versus market, which is an intangible. So I have some slides here that go through that. And then we have throwback sales and Public Law 86-272. And I think a lot of the confusion that pops up around here is how all of these terms and concepts fit together. Well, I'm going to go through this, and with any luck, it will sound very simple and make a lot of sense, but make no mistake, almost every piece on here is highly contentious business community. So our fake company here, it's 1C Corporation taxpayer. They have 88 million sales in the U.S., and they have $13 million of taxable income. This is what shows up on their federal tax return. And here are the companies that we're talking about. We have Corporation A. They're located in Washington, and they make furniture. Corporation B is located in Oregon, and they are a cabinet manufacturer. Corporation C is an interior design firm located in Idaho. So there's a theme there for those three companies and a relationship for them. And then you have Baseball Bats LLC, which is kind of a standalone company that's just out there. It's not really connected to the business per se. The key thing here is that corporations A and B deal with tangible personal property. And Corporation C is an intangible service provider. So the apportionment gets to be different. And here is all of the dollars associated with the company. We have Corporation A has $30 million of sales, $21 million in Washington and $9 million in Oregon. Corporation B has $30 million in sales, $12 million in Oregon and $18 million in Washington. And a key footnote here is that the sales that get exported for each of these companies are solicitation of sales only. They have no presence, they have no warehouse, they have no employees in the other state. It's just they're just soliciting sales. Corporation C has $20 million in sales, $7 million in Oregon, and $13 million in Idaho. And of the $7 million in Oregon, $2 million of them are performed in Oregon. And I apologize for the detail here, but these are the kinds of pieces of information that are necessary to try and highlight the key policy parameters. Other information I've included in here to get at some of the unitary concept, we have Baseball Bats LLC. They have $5 million in sales and $2 million in taxable income, but all of their sales are in Kentucky. So they're not really part of this unitary group. They're just a standalone. And then as another footnote, Washington has some rental property. The Corporation A has some rental property, and they earn $3 million in sales from that and $1 million in taxable income. So this picture right here is the same, what you just saw on the previous slide. And so walking through, before we get to apportionment, the main concerns. Okay, well, does this company have nexus in Oregon? They filed a tax return with Oregon, so at some level they feel that they have nexus in Oregon. The next question is unitary. They argue that corporations A, B, and C are unitary. They're basically in furniture, cabinet, interior design, and so they're, hopefully there's a theme there. But the Baseball Bats LLC is not unitary. It's not part of their household production. So they're not part of the unitary group, so they get removed from consideration here. Oregon won't tax them. They operate only in Kentucky. So the $5 million in sales and $2 million in income get pulled off the table. They get pulled out of the federal return. And then lastly, we have business income and non-business income. So the rental income in Washington, they're not in the business of rental properties, so that income is not part of the unitary group income. So that $3 million in sales and $1 million in income gets pulled off the table. That gets pulled out of the federal return. So that's the business, non-business, and the unitary, and they get pulled out.
Senator Bocas.
Okay, before you go to the next slide. Nexus, the corporation filed a tax return in Oregon, so they think they're in Oregon.
Correct. They feel in some way that they owe Oregon tax.
If you're using another example, could there not be a corporation that is just like this structure, but they don't file a tax return in Oregon?
That could certainly be. And in that case, the starting point would, the Department of Revenue would find them somehow and send them notification saying, hey, we think you owe Oregon tax, you need to file a tax return.
Okay, thank you.
And that's just the subtraction. So for the sales, the $88 million in U.S. sales gets brought down to $80 million sales. That's the pulling out of the unitary and the non-business. And the income gets reduced from $13 million down to $10 million. So we've taken care of the unitary and the non-business income. Again, the goal is, what is the Oregon tax liability? So now we have apportionment. So now this is what we're talking about, an $80 million company, or a company with $80 million in U.S. sales and $10 million in taxable income. All of this other information here is the same. I just pulled out the extraneous information. So we have federal taxable income of $10 million. That's kind of the starting point. The question is, how much can be taxed by Oregon, Washington, and Idaho? Because between the three companies, they have a footprint in each of those three states. Oregon uses the single sales factor. So what are the Oregon sales as a percentage of the U.S. sales? And that is simply a factor to determine how much of that $10 million in income Oregon gets to tax. The apportionment percentage, Oregon sales divided by U.S. sales. And then Oregon taxable income is the federal taxable income, the $10 million, multiplied by this apportionment percentage. And so then the question becomes, what sales go into that numerator? And I'm going to try and be very careful. Every once in a while, I will slip up and say taxable sales, and that causes some confusion. The discussion now is simply what sales go into the numerator for the purposes of determining the apportionment percentage. So scenario one, I just bring this icon or this image to every slide. It's the same. And then we have these terms over here, tangible and intangible, and Joyce Finnegan. So tangible, corporations A and B, services, corporation C. Joyce Finnegan are a Corp A and B issue, and cost of performance market is a corporation C issue. So what we have here under current law, the state Oregon uses Joyce and cost of performance. So while there's been agreement that this is a unitary group, the next step is which sales from each of these companies go into the numerator. And with Joyce, that decision gets made on an individual basis. We have to corporation by corporation. Finnegan, as we're going to see on the next slide, it's kind of an all-in or all-out. But Joyce is corporation by corporation. And so Corporation A is not taxable in Oregon. While they have Oregon sales, because those are just the solicitation of sales, Public Law 86272, that federal law, prevents Oregon from taxing them because basically they don't have enough of a presence here. Even though they're putting $9 million of sales in Oregon, they don't have physical location here in Oregon, for example. It's basically deemed to be a minimum connection to the state.
So would that be like a mail order or internet?
It could be.
Okay. That's what it has to be if they don't have a building down here.
Well, they can have salespeople coming in, but they don't have offices here.
Yeah.
There's no physical presence of the company in any way here. So they could have their sales office could be in Vancouver, and they travel into Oregon to make their sales. It could be internet based. It could be catalog based. Mm-hmm. Those mm-hmm. kinds of things. Okay.
It'd be a drug company with regional salespeople.
Okay. So again, this is Joyce. So we're making the determination one by one. Corp A is not taxable, so none of their sales will appear in the numerator, even though they've made $9 million of sales into Oregon. So now we go to Corporation B. Well, they're located here in Oregon. So we can go down to their plant, and they're physically producing their cabinets here. And so their $12 million of sales in Oregon obviously go into the numerator because they're here. Now the $18 million of sales that they actually make into Washington are thrown back to Oregon. Again, for the same protection that it's Public Law 86272, that law prevents the $9 million of Oregon sales for Corporation A from being taxable in Oregon. That same law says that the $18 million that are actually sold in Washington get thrown back to Oregon because of this assumption. There's no physical presence in the state of Washington. It's just salespeople.
So if they had a physical store in Washington, we wouldn't get that.
Correct.
Okay.
And cost of performance, it's relevant only for Corporation C. So now we figured out A contributes zero sales, B it's all of their sales from the sales in Oregon, and then the throwback. And for Corporation C, it's the $2 million. And here, even though they've made sales into Oregon of $7 million, for only $2 million of those sales, the actual service was provided in Oregon. Somebody came to Oregon and put together the designs. They met at the customer's office. They did all of the producing of those services, if you will, in Oregon. So those cost of production, the cost of performance, occurred in Oregon for those $2 million in sales. So because they left Idaho for the day or the week or whatever and came over to Oregon for this one contract of $2 million and they produced their service within Oregon's borders, that $2 million of sales is what establishes nexus for them in Oregon and is what gets taxed in Oregon. This one's a little more subtle because oftentimes when we've talked about this, we've talked about companies being subject to cost of performance and it's in or out for the entire company. That's not really, conceptually, it's okay to think about it, but that's not really how it works. It's on kind of a contract-by-contract basis within the company.
So this is Oracle, and the one when they come here and do stuff, that's taxed, and if they just send us a package, it's not?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, so to recap, for Corporation A, the Oregon activities are protected by federal law, so Oregon cannot tax them, so they get thrown back to Washington. Corporation B, we tax all of them because of the $12 million occurring in Oregon and the throwback from Washington to Oregon for that. It's the inverse, if that's the right term, for the sales that are exported. And then Corporation C, it's the $2 million. So summed together, that's a total of $32 million in sales, and the apportionment percentage is that $32 million divided by $80 million for the U.S., and that's a 40% apportionment percentage. So Oregon taxable income is $10 million times 40%, getting to $4 million. So this is kind of a current law situation. The next slide is Finnegan. So because Corporation B has nexus in Oregon, they all have nexus in Oregon and can be taxed in Oregon. So that's the key thing, Joyce Finnegan. Joyce is one company at a time. Finnegan is the entire unitary group. So now for Corporation A, again, we're talking about the numerator sales. The $9 million of sales into Oregon go into the numerator because they're taxable. In Corporation B, it's just the $12 million. You don't get the throwback sales anymore. And then the $2 million in sales stays the same because that's cost of performance, so that hasn't changed in this slide. So that totals $23 million in sales. So the apportionment percentage falls to about 29%, and then the Oregon taxable income falls similarly. So that's the Joyce Finnegan. Scenario three is we keep Joyce, and then we go to market-based for Corporation C. So for Corporation A, again, back under Joyce, none of those sales can be taxed in Oregon. Corporation B, all of those sales are taxed in Oregon, either because they occur in Oregon or because of throwback. And for Corporation C, now $7 million in sales go into the numerator. And that comes from the $7 million in sales that actually occur to Oregon, because now we've gone from cost of performance to a market base. The $7 million in sales occur in Oregon, so they go into the numerator. That total is $37 million. The apportionment percentage becomes about 46%, and then that's what gets multiplied by federal taxable income. And the fourth scenario is switching to Finnegan and market. So the numbers should start to look a little bit familiar. We get that for Corporation A, we get the $9 million in sales that occur in Oregon. For Corporation B, we only get the $12 million in sales that occur in Oregon. And for Corporation C, we get the $7 million in sales that occur in Oregon. For those same reasons. And then the apportionment percentage is 35% multiplied by federal taxable income gets to Oregon taxable income. So that's the key thing, the takeaway there. Joyce Finnegan is one corporation at a time versus the group. And for cost of performance and market, it's the difference between where the sales are delivered or consumed versus where they are, the cost to produce them occur.
So are there any questions as we continue the informational hearing? And I only said that because we're in an informational hearing now versus a regular hearing because we don't have a quorum.
Right, right. No question.
I do have a question. In each of these four scenarios, in theory, because we're talking about the dynamics between these, if you went to, you know, a gross receipts tax like, you know, the CAT or the B&O or so on and so forth, what happens under all any of these particular scenarios?
That kind of tax would mirror, I think, scenario four here, because you're really taxing the market and the sales and where the final customer is and where the services or tangible goods are consumed. It's a destination based.
So if you had a CAT or a B&O and that replaced the entire corporate income tax, and we'll just say hypothetically the partnerships and the businesses and the rest of that sort of stuff, then we'd really by default switch to a Finnegan plus market. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the difference is the Finnegan and market is a way of getting at it's a way of determining the apportionment percentage. Mm-hmm. And that apportionment percentage gets applied to the taxable income. It's opposed to, under the alternatives you're suggesting, it's a direct tax on those sales.
Check.
Here, it's just the point is how much of this federal taxable income can Oregon tax? And these are just different methods of calculating that percentage.
But again, if you went to a CAT, which is a gross tax, or a B&O, which is a gross tax, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would any of these four scenarios really apply? If you replaced, they would all go out the window, right? You
right,
wouldn't have a Finnegan versus Joyce, or a cost of performance versus market.
Correct. All of this goes away. Because all of this is the question of how much federal taxable income does Oregon get to tax? And these are all ways of answering that question. So all of this becomes irrelevant under a commercial activities tax, for example, a gross receipts tax.
Now that you're back, wow. Mr. Chair, follow up.
Follow up. That's a pretty important point.
Yeah, it is. It's a big point. It's just going to get bigger before the session gets over, unfortunately. So if you went in these scenarios of how we're trying to calculate sales, right, and because we went through these four different deals, even though we're just talking about the numerator, we're talking about, you know, market versus performance, choice versus all of this sorts over. If you had a CAT or a B&O or that sort of gross receipts tax along that line, and we were going out and say what portion of sales, would that sort of tax be only on Oregon sales?
Yes. I mean, it's a destination-based.
Right.
And if they're sold in Oregon, if they're consumed in Oregon, then they would be subject to the tax.
So if you took your three boxes that are up here on the screen, and of course I cannot see them, and my glasses aren't that, but just take Corporation, I guess, B, and we determined Corporation B had Oregon sales of $12 million, right? That's what a CAT or a B&O or a gross receipts tax would be applied against, correct?
Correct. Another important piece about a gross receipts tax is it would be applied to additional business forms. All of this discussion okay. is how much of the C corporation income tax can be taxed by Oregon. Well, all of this complications around that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So then, in terms of if you did a any one of these varieties of, you know, gross receipt tax, you know, pick one, Texas, B&O. Nevada, Washington, whatever it is, when you're doing it in that structure that we're talking about in that talk of gross receipts tax, is the would we still in theory have a unitary filing and then they would subdivide underneath there and tell us, or would it be a non-unitary filing and they would only file for the companies separately, or is that just once again a choice of what we would want to do and not want to do?
We haven't gotten to that level of detail. I think it would be a choice. I don't know that it matters, because part of the reason for unitary, again, is the concept is they're taxing income. And so when you're in unitary, you have a situation where the income of one company can offset the losses of another company. Those are all income concepts, net income concepts. When we move to a gross receipts tax, we've stepped away from that concept and all of the complexities in these slides. And so whether or not we would tax each of these three company sales in Oregon separately or as a group, I think becomes an administrative issue, because that volume of sales doesn't change. We would be talking about the $9 million from Corporation A, the $12 million from Corporation B, and the $7 million from Corporation C. There could be a benefit to having them file one return, but it won't affect that. You won't have positive sales in one and from one company offsetting negative sales from another company. Not that I can envision right now.
Is there a structure in which you could make the single sales consistent and work in both gross receipts and income based?
I'm not sure I follow to make the gross receipts as similar as possible to this.
Yeah.
I think that's what the scenario four would
four,
be.
Yeah.
Because this gets at between Finnegan and market, it's really just getting at the actual sales in the state. Because one of the complexities here is throwback sales and public law 86-272.
Okay.
Those are no longer an issue because they're income-related issues. So it really does get at the sales in Oregon, and that's what this scenario four here is. Corporation A, $9 million of sales into Oregon is right here. Corporation B only has $12 million in sales in Oregon. They come right here. And then Corporation C has $7 million in sales in Oregon, and that's right here. So this apportionment, this single sales factor calculation mirrors that most closely.
I have a question. If we're going to walk down this path for the next 3 months, I have some questions.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris. This is going to get complex, and everybody's going to get lost out there, but I don't think you are, okay? So in the throwback, which is, you know, you're determining an apportionment, in the model you have up there, and we'll just use the Oregon versus Washington, if you had an Oregon credit that you sold to Washington, okay, and it's now in Washington, okay, and you have the throwback from Washington, even though you have credit now, is housed, in, and I don't know whether it's tangible or intangible, okay, but it's housed in Washington, and then that revenue is suddenly thrown back under the throwback rule to Oregon. Is that credit that you had, that your unitary corporation had in Washington, can you apply that credit against your Oregon taxes?
We're talking about an income tax credit, right?
Sort of, yes. But yes, we'll use an income tax credit as the...
If I followed you clearly, yes, because the income tax credit would be the bottom line tax of the unitary group.
Okay.
So all of this noise is getting to that number. So whatever that taxable income is and tax, the credit gets used against that.
Okay. So what we just said is, if you had an Oregon credit, you sold the credit to Washington, right? And it was in Washington, but if the Washington corporation has been a throwback, it comes back to us. Is the inverse correct? If you had a Washington credit, okay, and the Washington entity sold the credit to an Oregon entity, right? And then Oregon had the throwback rule through Oregon's income someplace else. Where does the credit get used?
The credit follows the corporation. I am trying to keep up. The credit will follow the corporation. So I wasn't sure if you were talking about back and forth between these two companies, or if you were introducing.
No, I'm not
just
talking
any
about
company.
Right.
So any company.
Tradable credit.
Okay, so that gets sold on the open market.
Check.
Presumably, the company who buys it feels that they have some level of Oregon tax liability, however that is determined.
Okay.
And the credit would follow that company, and they would claim it on their tax return.
Okay, follow up. If the throwback rule was the inverse, right, and you no longer had it, but say it's a Washington credit, as we did, Washington went to Oregon, got that one. If it's the same scenario but the inverse, and now the throwback's in Oregon and it was a credit that was established in Washington, why would Oregon accept that credit?
Well, the throwback is a way. I think the issues are a little bit separate in that the throwback just deals with how many sales go into the numerator. It's all just a complicated method of what is the Oregon percentage.
Right.
So, for the credit that gets, especially for a credit that can be sold on the open market, just like any other commodity, then whoever earns it did something to earn that credit in accordance with Oregon tax law, assuming law, compliance. And then they can sell it to whoever can use it, and whoever buys it will use it against the Oregon tax liability. I'm not seeing any connection between that process and throwbacks. So either I'm not following or it's just a commingling of two separate concepts, because that is one of the when I talk to folks, the throwback gets perceived as a way of determining how much income gets taxed by Oregon, and in a sense that's correct, but it does it through this mechanism of the single sales factor. All the throwback does is change that numerator number. Now that's a big deal to companies, because you change that numerator and that affects how much Oregon taxable income, but it's a step removed from the actual taxable income piece.
Sir, Riley, did you have a question?
So I just wanted to clarify. So what you're saying is that an Oregon tax credit is always a credit against Oregon taxes, and a Washington tax credit is always a credit against Washington taxes, no matter where it's housed.
Correct. I mean, Washington doesn't have an income tax,
but
we're ignoring that piece.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Follow up, and I'm assuming if you move from intrastate to international, right? Interstate to international, the same thing that Senator Rani said applies, correct?
Yes. I can't think of a reason why it wouldn't right now.
Okay. One follow up question, I think. Sure. So then, that being said, it follows it. But what you really also said that is once you get through the 1 through 4 here, okay, all of that, and you have this credit, okay, whether it's in Oregon or Washington, because of the percentages, if the credit was issued by Washington and you your numerator was 40% and Washington got 60%, you could apply those credits in their respective states where they originated. That's really what a different way of restating what Senator Ryan is saying, correct?
Yes, if we're now talking about a hypothetical Washington income tax credit and an Oregon income tax credit.
And then okay. Washington has no income tax, right?
Let's add some more hypotheticals to that.
But actually, this isn't hypothetical at all. This is real, but that's the problem with this whole thing. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And I'm going someplace, but I'm not going to get there today, but we're going to get there, unfortunately. And you're the one that told me to go do this, Mr. Chair. I'm just telling you, okay? So if the credits that you had, right, and you're sitting on these two credits, one in Oregon, one in Washington, as was pointed out by Senator Riley, Washington doesn't have an income tax credit, right? Now, so there's that credit, and Oregon has an income tax credit. If in first step, if Oregon went to a gross receipts of some sort, this credit now in credit terms, let me say this carefully, in credit terms of applying against your tax as a credit, right, is no longer valid, correct? It's useless.
That is a significant policy question that would be before you.
Okay.
That is one possible outcome.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And it's my last question, because everybody out there has no clue what I'm talking about.
No, it's okay.
I think Senator Riley knows where I'm going here. If this credit you had, though, is no longer valid as a credit on your, under GAAP, right, general accounting, whatever it is, all the accounting crap you guys use, okay? Under those accounting principles and on your IRS code, if you had to purchase the credit, okay, of course you could, for some regulatory purpose, you could in fact deduct that on your federal taxes. Is that not correct?
The purchase of the tax credit from the IRS.
Say it was a tax credit. I said it's a credit. Don't confuse.
Okay, I'm sorry, I got lost then.
So you're required to have this credit, right, to do business, and it's a regulatory deal. If you purchase that credit, if you're the Oregon company and you need a credit and they have it in Washington and you purchase it, the expense of purchasing that credit is deductible on your federal taxes, correct?
You've purchased a tax credit?
No, you've purchased a credit.
Okay.
The government told you must possess X number of these, and you've purchased it.
If it's part of, it sounds like you're getting a business expense, and in that case, it would be deductible. Okay. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
It may not be deductible on your state tax, right, because you don't have income tax.
Correct. If we move away from an income tax, then the income tax deduction is no longer
okay. One final question, the actual inverse, Mr. Chair.
Another final question, sure.
Yeah, of course, right. It's not a final question. It's part B of the final question, and there will be no part C.
All right.
I'm assuming, therefore, the inverse of the balance sheet is correct, is as if you had a liability and you had to sell it at a loss or something along that line. That, of course, would be, we don't know what it is at this point, and I'm not asking you for that answer. Paul knows where I'm going here exactly. Is that, and there is no answer at this point, but it is if you sold that either as a tangible real property or an intangible, that loss could end up being a loss of some sort, either a business deduction or a capital loss or a capital gains loss or something. Is that not correct?
Correct, depending on the nature of the it, okay. But it would be some kind of loss.
I do have a C, but I won't ask it, Mr. Chair, but that's all right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
These are the kinds of questions. I think the one thing that we're seeing is those of us who thought we were conversant in cost of performance versus market-based really didn't understand how technical and deep this is in terms of.
Yeah, often, and I've done this, but you describe it, it's almost, an onion cliche or something there, where it's talked about as a company, but it's really sales. So one way to get within that is contracts. So the example here, and that's the reason I put this example up here, because it gets at another layer of the cost of performance, that it's not a company issue, it's a sales within the company issue. So, for example, a contract-by-contract basis issue. And companies can, most of the companies probably have some sales that are tangible as well as service. And so it only gets, unfortunately, it only gets more complicated.
and they have good lawyers.
Well, this it is more complicated than I than I wanted to delve into, but that doesn't mean it's insurmountable as a policy goal to make our system more consistent. Okay, no more questions or no more final questions, parts A or B?
Part C.
We'll take a break from this discussion until maybe next week or in the future, and I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 28.
Maybe your work session?
Yeah, we're not going to do 29.
You could, yeah.
Is that complex?
Let's do the work sessions now. We'll pass these bills out of the way, even though Herman and...
Mr. Chair, I do not have the paperwork on 148. We do have it on 32 and 33, and you also have a bill for introduction.
Where's the bloody bill? Where's the introduction bill?
What's that?
There has it.
Okay.
The bill for introduction.
Oh, it's the ballot measure bill.
Yeah, I can't make a motion if I don't have the text.
Well, I'm going to go into a work session on bill introduction.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3548, dated 2-10-17, be introduced as a committee bill, and I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves that LC 3548 be introduced as a committee bill. Discussion, Senator Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, you know, a vote on the introduction of a legislative concept does not mean a member either supports or opposes it. It's simply bringing it up for discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Objection? Seeing none, bill is introduced. And I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 32 to get a quick summary on this and any discussion we might have. We took this up, I guess it's been 2 weeks ago now.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 32 would eliminate the, there's currently a 5% penalty in the statutes related to the estate tax. And it would eliminate a penalty for failure to pay and an additional penalty for initial failure to file the estate tax return. And it would instead make it so that there is one 5% penalty for either of those things, but not both. And that's to be in line with the other types of laws related to other tax programs.
Right.
So the Senate Bill 32 is found to have no fiscal impact and also a minimal revenue impact. It's possible for people to file extensions with their estate tax, and it's possible that 5% of some return could be taxed or assessed twice as a penalty and currently, and then this measure would make it so that it was assessed only once. And so it's possible that it may have some revenue impact at some point, but I consider it to be a minimal revenue impact.
Okay. Thank you. And we had testimony from the Revenue Department on this to those points. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 32 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 32 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just slightly, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
This is too easy of a bill for Senator Taylor to carry if it's a reverse bill, so I'll carry it if it passes.
Oh, okay. Further discussion, seeing none. Objection, seeing none. And we've passed our first bill of the session. Senate Bill 32 will go to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Boquist has volunteered to carry it. Thank you. Close that work session and open up a work session on Senate Bill 33.
Okay. Senate Bill 33 would change the computation of interest by the Department of Revenue from a monthly rate to an annual percentage rate computed daily. It applies to both amounts that the Department of Revenue owes taxpayers and the amounts the taxpayers owe to the Department of Revenue. And it changes the following tax programs: amusement device tax, cigarette tax, consumer cigarette tax, co-ops, corporate excise tax, corporate income tax, corporate multi-state tax, emergency communications, 911 tax, estate tax programs, hazardous substance tax, inheritance tax, Lane payroll tax, Lane SE tax, and other tobacco products tax, personal income tax, and partnership minimum tax. And so it applies to all of those. The bill was found to have a minimal fiscal impact and also a minimal revenue impact because it does affect both taxes owed and owing, and it may change the calculation just very slightly in some cases, but the direction of that change isn't uniform, so it's overall considered to be an average of zero impact, but it could be minimal because it may change things ever so slightly.
Okay, thank you, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 33 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 33 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Noting that there's at least six different versions of taxes here with six different versions of questions, this is a perfect bill for the junior senator to carry.
Well, I was thinking she might want the revisor's bill.
I like the revisor's bill for her, but that's okay.
Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 33 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Riley, why don't we go with you and we'll go down there. And Senate Bill 148 is not quite there.
We'll carry it over. We'll have it tomorrow.
Yes, yeah, so we'll carry it over until tomorrow.
Well, this is the one with 26 different items in it. Yeah,
and,
okay.
And so we'll close those work sessions and Senate Bill 29, Paul, are we?
Nobody signed up.
Yes. Well, let's open up a quick public hearing and go through a summary. A summary of Senate Bill 29 and among other things we can answer why it's even here.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 29 was brought by the Department of Revenue. And it updates a date and statute, a bankruptcy date, from April 15th, 1995 to December 31st, 2016. And generally, these kinds of dates are in the Reconnect bill, but this particular date has to do with bankruptcy law as opposed to tax law. So this came to the Department of Revenue's attention recently. So it comes from them, but that's the only change. It just updates that date.
Okay, so Jeff Henderson is signed. Here he is. Jeff,
come up. Updates the void, but why?
He's here to give us the why part of this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Henderson, Oregon Department of Revenue. As Chris mentioned, this came to our attention, and we just saw this as an inequity in statute. We wanted to bring this to your attention. Federal law controls when it comes to the bankruptcy provisions. And currently the reference in statute in 314.306 points back to an outdated version of that federal law. So bringing this to your attention today to just see that the federal provision was revised in 2005 and it became effective as of October 17th, 2005. So for the provisions applied to the tax treatment applicable to discharges of indebtedness and bankruptcy, for those cases that commenced on or after that effective date of the federal revision, our current provision in statute is outdated, incorrect.
Senator Boquist.
Oh, I love it. This is kind of like water, Mr. Chair. So if the federal law changes 2005, then why are we changing the date to December 31st, 2016?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, good question. Maybe that's a question better asked of alleged counsel. I'm not sure what Chris maybe touched on this briefly, but
I think the general idea, and from in my conversations with alleged counsel, is to tie to the most recent date in history, in the past. So it's 2016. And all of the other federal connect provisions are tied to December 31st, 2016. Or actually, right now it's December 31st, 2015. There'll be a bill to update that to December 31st, 2016. So I think it's more a a convention to go to the most recent date. So if the provision of law, in this particular case, it may not matter if that bankruptcy law hadn't changed between October 17th, 2005 and December 31st, 2016. But I think it's more a matter of convention and style for the most recent date.
Senator Riley?
Is it not possible for us to put in law instead of a date, so the wording most recent law?
I think that's straight. Again, from my, these are alleged counsel questions, but my conversations with them, because this comes up with the reconnect, it has to do with the inability of the legislature to abdicate its responsibility to anybody else. The only provision under the Constitution where that's allowed is the definition of taxable income. And that's where we get the rolling reconnect, where we can tie to the current definition of taxable income, whatever it is, and whatever federal change it, federal law changes affect that affects us immediately. So that's a plus and minus thing. But everything else has to be to a specific date in the past.
And that's constitutional?
In the Oregon Constitution.
Okay,
counsel, follow-up question then. You can't shit in here, right? You're not getting paid for being labeled, so I guess you're not violating the bar here. But you, we're comparing this to the federal rolling reconnect that we annually do. And the reason we don't just plug this into the federal reconnect is because this has to do with bankruptcy law versus tax law. Is that why we're doing it differently?
In the, I asked that same question of counsel, and they there was a... Well, the answer was, well, it's not really tax law, it's bankruptcy law, so it got its own bill.
Okay.
In the future, it may get pulled into the reconnect law because it's that kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But for this particular time, it was just part of this. As an example, part of the reconnect now, there are about 10 sections that relate to PERS. And for a long time, that was not part of the reconnect bill.
Mm-hmm.
But within the past 10 years, it got added to the reconnect bill because it's this conversation around tying to federal law. So for this session right now, that's a different bill. In the future, it could be part of the reconnect, so that might be an option for the committee if you wanted to not move on this bill but have an amendment into the reconnect bill. But that right now, alleged counsel was still kind of debating back and forth whether or not it would fit in to the reconnect bill because bankruptcy law versus tax law.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm fine either way, but I'm just trying to understand and put on the record here. But if you have bankruptcy law, because we have disconnected, okay, and we connect with December 31st, 2016 under the corporate treatment of indebtedness under bankruptcy, but we don't connect with the federal tax law, is there any place that there could be differentials in the tax treatment in bankruptcy court because we didn't connect with the federal treatment, federal law?
That's a good question. I don't know right now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, it's our understanding that federal law controls when it comes to to these provisions for indebtedness, discharge, and the bankruptcy. So regardless, if we update that reference in our statute, federal law will control. Oregon is bound to follow those federal provisions if revised.
Well, question, just to make sure we're clear here. So what DOR is saying is that there is no reason or no purpose that this bankruptcy connection has to be tied in any manner whatsoever to the federal reconnect. That's what DOR's position is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, not entirely, because I guess because of, to the point that Chris made about Ledge Council saying there needed to be a date, a reference date to placed in the provision. That makes sense. But federal law will control when it comes to these provisions.
We don't even need this law, apparently.
Right, and it doesn't, and it really has no impact on the federal reconnect. That's what I'm hearing DOR say. Versus.
Well, it's been wrong for 12 years, so.
We're wrong all the time. I'm just trying to make sure we have this down. I don't care either way,
all right.
Sure.
Okay, we'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. We'll close a public hearing on Senate Bill 29. So, thanks for covering all that ground today. We'll be back tomorrow. We are adjourned. We'll be back tomorrow. We are adjourned.